With the section sealed off, Barron's team was responsible for damage assessment and control in the starboard aft compartments of troop deck. Barron sent his team off to take readings in each compartment. He stayed by the command console, from which he could report results or receive orders. He felt a lurch in his stomach.
The gravity generators again?
And glanced at the gauge nearest him. Sure enough, a 2% negative spike. The lights dimmed, then brightened. Missile launches.
Are we taking hits, sir?
Missile launchers.
Barron looked up at Petty Officer O'Neill. Their eyes met, and he saw that O'Neill was watching him just as he watched the others. O'Neill gave a short nod.
That was incoming.
O'Neill grinned for a moment.
Check the seals first.
Pressure had to be all right. He would have felt it if it hadn't been. He glanced down at his console. Two decks down, a red blaze expanded across the ship's schematic.
Hull breach, report all starboard aft teams.
Barron pressed his code key and read off the current numbers.
Serrano, get your team to environmental. Go down the port side access. Watch the heads up on the way down in case the aft locks don't hold.
Barron tried to remember what he'd been told about hull breaches. Everything tried to escape to vacuum. The air and all that could be moved by the explosive decompression. This left the damaged area clear, usually, of the noxious gases and thick smoke that endangered personnel when the ship was still whole, but some system had fractured. But the next compartments, where there might be pressure loss, were likely to be cold, dark, and confusing. In the aft portside passage, Barron and his team met up with the officer on site. The Major glanced at his name tag.
Serrano, good. We want you in SE-14. Pressure's dropping, slow enough that it must be fairly small, but big enough to indicate nothing's plugged it yet. Your report channel is 11. Cycle through two at a time and be careful. Pressure differential's enough to knock you off your feet. You'll go in number four, got that?
Barron led the way into the lock. When it opened on the far side, he faced the starboard passage, now lit only by emergency lighting, and the long emergency bulkhead that separated the passage from the plumbing works of environmental. Along it, several preformed partial pressure locks showed, each clearly labeled. He located number four, and as the rest of his team cycled through, he opened the number four emergency locker and handed out the elements of the single-person pressure lock. This was something they'd drilled in often enough. Place the frame to the existing frame and seal, pop open the rest, and check that the other side of the lock was closed. The first person through did not actually cycle through, but was pushed by the suction that pulled the lock into the low-pressure chamber and held it extended until the second locked the frame in place. Barron checked that everything was ready, took another look at his suit readouts, grabbed hold of the safety bar of what would become the low-pressure side of the inner hatch, and popped the bulkhead's preformed opening. The emergency airlock sucked through the opening with all the force of the pressure differential, hit him in the back like a truck, and he barely kept his grip on the safety bar. All around was a dark, dense, cold, whirling wind. He could see nothing, but he could feel the buffeting of air currents and the cold now rapidly falling to the freezing point of water. His feet slithered on something incredibly slippery.
Ice already?
Barron turned on his helmet lamp and saw swirling fog, streamers of vapor pouring away from left to right. Environmental was the wettest place on the ship, barring the water reserves or a shower in use. Here, the air was more humid than anywhere else, and decompression chilled it below its ability to hold that water as invisible vapor.
Locks up, sir.
Come through, but watch it. It's slippery, dark, and windy in here.
Break safety lines.
Why didn't I think of that?
His suit had all the attachments ready. Barron managed to get the primary hookup out of its fitting and attached to the lock's safety bar. Now he could move away a little, look for other points of attachment. He tried a cautious step away from the hatch and skidded on the wet deck, slithering into something round and hard.
A culture tank?
His helmet light didn't show him anything identifiable but the fat, shiny haunch of a metallic tank of some kind. It looked shinier than it should, and he rubbed it with his gloved hand, then wiped the glove on the chem patch. A formula he didn't recognize came up on his suit display. Not all water, then. It had a lot of C and H and O and some Cl.
Hydrocarbon.
He didn't need a laundry list to think of hydraulic fluid. Slippery, flammable, and, if coming from a high-pressure leak, lethal to get near. Baron switched his suit comm to Channel 11.
This is Serrano in SE-14. I found a possible hydraulic fluid leak in Number 4.
Acknowledge, Serrano. Take appropriate precautions.
He switched back to his own unit's channel.
Sir?
I'm over here.
Baron rotated his head, sending his helmet light in all directions.
I slid over here. We've got hydraulic fluid as well as water vapor. Show your lamps.
Three feeble glows that could have been any distance.
Right, sir. We have five more to cycle through. Three now clipped on the same safety bar. Have you found any other attachment points?
No, not yet.
Baron had only 3 meters of line on the primary attachment, and they couldn't all clip onto the same bar. There wasn't room. They could clip on each other, but they still needed other attachment points. He edged his way around the metal tank and found a handle of some sort. When he tugged, it held firm. By leaning close with his headlamp, he could see that it opened by turning, with a safety latch holding it closed. Good enough.
Found an attachment. Who's in?
Juan, Talene, Preston.
Juan, clip onto my line. Trail a line to the lock and come to me.
Baron felt the vibration in his safety line as someone moved, and was there beside him.
It's only about 2 meters, sir, but you can't see anything in this murk.
True enough. Let's have that line.
Baron used a running clip to attach the line Juan had trailed to the attachment he'd found. Now anyone could come that way.
Now you clip in.
Juan did so, keeping a safety grip on Baron's line while unclipping his own and reclipping it onto the tank handle.
Talene, find my line and give it a tug. Now, unclip my line and put it on the trailer.
It took a tediously long time to cycle everyone through the lock safely, make sure they were all clipped in, and advance through the greasy murk toward the actual leak. Since the problem was known, at least in part, four of the last in the chain lugged a great awkward roll of bulkhead fabric, which, when stretched across a gap and foamed, would provide an airtight seal with some structural integrity. Baron, in the lead, slithered and slid from one obstacle to another, barking his shins and his ribs on things he couldn't see clearly until he fell over them. This was only fair, he knew, since he had less actual experience than most of the team. He knew he was going the right way because the wisps and tendrils of vapor blew past him. All he had to do was follow. He reported at intervals when his helmet display prompted him to. Suddenly, his headlamp threw back a bright sparkle. A rime of ice now outlined a line of pipe and shapes that should be a row of scrubbers. He could see past them to an irregular white shape bordering a jagged black line.
Could that be the...
His boot slid on the greased, icy decking again, as the strengthening current of escaping air and vapor whipped about him and sucked him toward the gap. He managed not to yelp and felt the jerk when his safety tether came up short.
Don't worry, sir. We've got you.
Baron tried to think of something offhand and casual to say, but couldn't. That black crack. He couldn't see how big it was, really. Not big enough for his whole body, surely. But an arm or a hand, perhaps.
All that ice. We're supposed to patch on a dry, clean surface.
We can always torch it off.
No, this vapor may be explosive. It's got hydraulic fluid in it, remember?
Well, then we'll...
A fan of light brighter than the brightest day scythed into the compartment through the crack, giving structure and substance for a moment to the roll of vapor, striking blinding highlights off the ice.
What was that?
The war's not over. The battle's still going on, and it's time we quit sightseeing.
Baron knew he should have said that, but he was noticing the glow. It had not died instantly. It came again, another flash.
Hitting the shields. Hope they hold.
This is Serrano. We've located a hull breach in Number 4, but the margins are coated in ice. We'll have to get that off before we can patch it.
Acknowledge, Serrano. Be careful, but be quick.
Ackman, you and Juan get to chipping it off.
Wanna just reform?
Baron was glad someone else had asked that question.
Notice there's less fog? Most of the water vapor's out now, and the pressure and temp are both way down. Pretty soon it'll be clear enough to see.
It already was, Baron saw when he flashed his lamp around. The fog was below waist level. He could shine his light all the way back to the portable airlock. Something glittered across the darkness, a fine wire. No, the hydraulic leak, still spitting a fine stream of the fluid. He called in the location of the line so damage control could shut off the pressure. Another scythe of light blazed through the crack. Baron ignored it. They still had to fix the leak. Very carefully, in short moves, each restrained by a tether, they moved toward the crack. Ackman and Juan chipped the ice off the bulkhead.
Carefully. We don't want to damage it. Lay your irons down just about horizontal to it.
They chipped from the outside toward the crack. Baron and the others unrolled the patch material and cut off strips to use as supporting surfaces. As soon as they cleared ice from a strip, someone laid down a bead of adhesive and a strip of patch material. No more ice formed on the upper surface of the patch cloth rimming the crack. Baron laid another bead of adhesive on the cloth rim and then, turning the roll around, put the end of the roll flush with the bead at the bottom and began unrolling upwards, sealing one side, while Aver sealed the other. The suction was less now, but still pulled the patch cloth tight against the crack. Someone, Baron couldn't tell who, pumped the foam gun and sprayed quickset foam on the cloth.
One leak down. Are there others?
Baron checked the pressure in the compartment and realized it was so low they'd have to wait quite a while to be sure. He reported in to the damage control officer.
We need you to do a check of the environmental system.
We don't have any moles.
That's all right. You don't need to make it run. Just report on what you find. I've got a checklist. I'm flashing it to your suit comp.
Yes, sir.
What he could see of the list in his heads-up display looked easy enough. Check each tank for leakage, check the lines, test for certain contaminants. Baron recognized some of these, but not all.
You'll report on Channel 6. That's the environmental officer this shift, but don't bother him unless you have to. They're trying to patch the remains of the starboard system upstream of you into the hard chem backups.
This meant nothing to Baron, who had always considered environmental the dullest of all specialties. Of course, it was important. Everyone liked to breathe. But it had none of the glamour of drives or weapons. He had passed the required courses by dint of dutiful memorization, and he'd put most of it out of his mind immediately after the exam. The checklist was long and detailed. Every vat, chamber, pump, connection, pipe and tube, and the whole place was full of them. Baron looked at the time, at his own air supply, and calculated that they'd have to cycle out for air at least once. He wanted a margin of safety. He'd send half the team out when they had an hour's air left, then the other half. He set his suit alarm to remind him to check with the petty officer and took his half team up to the forward end of the compartment. Here, there was less ice on the deck. Baron flashed his headlamp around and wondered if it would be safe to rig lights. It would speed up their assessment. He clicked on his comm unit.
Yes?
Serrano with damage control in SE-14. Is it safe to rig lights in here?
What's your gas situation?
Baron called Juan over. Juan had the chem scan and had him read off the numbers.
That sounds safe enough. No methane, no hydrogen sulfide. See any big leaks?
No methane, no hydrogen sulfide. I'm not sure my chem scan has all that stuff on the list.
No visible leaks since they cut off that hydraulic line, but we can't see much yet.
All right, then. Rig your lights, but watch your pressure. We're not airing up that compartment until it's secure, so any increase in pressure means you've got a leak or something coming in. Some of that stuff's nasty.
Yes, sir. Petty Officer O'Neill, we have clearance from Environmental to rig lights. We should probably bring in something to sop up the flammable stuff on the floor as well.
Yes, sir.
A few minutes later, two of his team came back in, lugging strings of lights and a sack of the flocculant for the deck. With light strung as best they could, the damage was certainly more visible. Bulkhead material had spalled in a broad cone across the aft end of the compartment. There, most of the tanks and vats were dented, and one was holed, with a now frozen mass of stringy stuff, Baron couldn't guess, firmly adhering to the side of the tank and the deck. Chunks of bulkhead, like big flakes of obsidian, lay where they'd fallen. He walked around, noting which tanks were damaged and how badly. When he got back to the forward bulkhead, he checked the pressure gauge. 78. It was up, but very slightly.
Juan, what's our gas mix?
Oxygen's up a point, sir, but with this low pressure...
Oxygen is the least of our problems.
Baron spotted the green O2 lines and started checking them. Oxygen was breathable. It wasn't going to poison anyone, even if it was leaking. And at very low pressure and temperature, it wasn't likely to support combustion either.
Anything else?
No, sir. Nothing I can identify. But most of the stuff on the list you flashed me isn't on this chem scan selector.
It's not? What have you got, then?
Well, what you mostly need. Oxygen, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen.
but not all that special environmental stuff.
Let's see.
Baron took a look. There was oxygen, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, all at very low amounts.
What about broad scan? Did you try that?
Yes, sir, but I don't know what all these little peaks are. None of them are red marked.
So probably it was picking up traces of whatever had been in the breached vessels. Maybe some outgassing from the patch adhesive. He looked at the scan readout himself, but while whatever it was had a molecular weight of around 16, he didn't know what it might be. He tried to envision the periodic table, but most of it eluded him.
Oxygen? No, that's atomic weight. The molecular weight is 32.
Baron looked around and saw a tangle of green lines, the oxygen code, snaking around a series of long tanks. There was an obvious place to look for an oxygen leak. Even if you could breathe it, it still shouldn't be leaking out. He started at the nearest tank and tested every connection with his squirt bottle. On the second, little bubbles rewarded him. Sure enough, something was coming out, and the most likely thing coming out of a green-coated line was oxygen. He called up the checklist and protocol and found that he needed a special patch. Which pocket had he put it in? There. He peeled off the backing, glad that whoever made these things realized they'd have to be used by people in gloves. That long pull tag helped. He looked around again to see where his team was. O'Neill and his group were down at the most damaged aft end. The rest were scattered up and down the compartment, checking every bit of tubing for leaks. That unknown peak on the readout bothered him. He called the environmental officer again.
Sir, we've got a peak our chem scan doesn't identify. Something with a molecular weight of 16.
He flashed the readout to the EO.
What do you mean the chem scan doesn't... 16? Lieutenant, didn't I tell you to look out for methane? What's the readout?
Methane.
That was the one that blew up when it contacted free oxygen.
Sir, we don't have a readout for it on our machine.
Oh, my God. You don't have an environmental chem scan. Lieutenant, get your people out now. You're sitting on a bomb.
Baron had already figured that out. Terror and guilt almost strangled him. He pushed them down. Right now, he had to get his people to safety.
Wait. Tell them to move slowly. If they run through a pool of the stuff and mix it, that's when it'll blow. Turn off those lights you rigged. Can you vent to vacuum?
We just...
Baron called his team.
Emergency!
Heads turned toward him.
We have a potentially explosive gas mix. Don't run. We don't want to move the stuff around more than we have to. Whoever's closest to the lock, douse the lights. The lock. The portable airlock. Will it hold pressure if there's an explosion?
Baron switched back to the EO.
Sir, we accessed SE-14 through a portable airlock. If this compartment goes, it may not hold.
I've already alerted them, Lieutenant. Get your people out, vent to the vacuum if you can.
If they took the patch off, at least it wouldn't be an explosion in a closed space.
We could try to take the patch off.
He hoped the EO would say it was impossible, not worth the risk.
Do it! If there's an explosion in that compartment, we could lose the whole ship.
And it would be his fault, because he hadn't checked to see that they had a chem scan programmed for environmental. Baron switched back to the team channel and checked to see who was nearest. Talene and O'Neill.
Petty Officer O'Neill.
Baron saw down the compartment. O'Neill turned towards him.
We need to vent this compartment immediately to vacuum. The EO has authorized us to tear down that patch. You four by the airlock. Get out, now. Has anyone identified a methane line leak?
If it's from a tank, it'll be in the outboard array, about a third of the way aft in the chamber. If it's a line, it could be anywhere.
Baron glanced over and saw Pivot Gormley standing approximately in that location, about 7 meters away.
What have you got, Gormley?
Dent. In the fermentation chamber, sir. There's a kind of crack in this little pipe here from some sort of collection tank. I could seal it.
It's too late. You're probably standing in a pool of methane. If you stir it up...
Gormley, stay where you are. Do not move. I'm standing by the photosynthesis chamber, and there's a crack in the oxygen line.
Baron looked down, and at that moment, someone cut the lights.
Lieutenant?
I'm standing in the oxygen. If I don't kick it around, this explosion may not happen. You get that patch torn down. Everybody who's not with you, except Gormley and me, get out. But don't run.
Baron could see their headlamps moving. He could see them cycling through. Surely they'd be safer in the corridor. Surely someone would get them through the blast doors to the other side of the ship. He found himself counting the disappearing lights.
One safe. Two. 4.
Sir, I'm scared.
That was Gormley, the kid, the newest of the bunch. And he, Baron, had condemned this kid to die, maybe.
Well, I'm not any too happy myself, but if we don't dance a jig, we can still get out of this in one piece.
Do you really think so?
Of course, he didn't think so, but it would do no good to tell the kid that.
If they get that patch off, the rest of the gases in here will vent a vacuum. It's cold now, it'll be colder then, and it takes heat.
But not much, he knew. Not with methane and oxygen. Fire damp. Miner's enemy. Anything might set it off.
And even if it blows, it won't be confined.
I don't like this. I can't just stand here.
Sure you can. Smartest thing you can do.
Another light, and another, vanished out the airlock. 4 remained, at the aft end of the chamber, working to remove the patch they'd tried so hard to put on.
If we don't mix the two, they won't blow up.
But sir, we're all walking around, all over. They gotta be mixed already.
It hasn't blown yet. I promise not to kick my oxygen at you if you won't kick your methane at me.
Are you scared, sir?
Of course he was scared, but Gormley probably didn't need to hear it.
Got a leak, Lieutenant. We'll just widen her out a bit. She's spalled off quite a lot. We should be able to get more open.
Baron started to ask if they had their safety lines hooked on, and realized that that was probably not a high priority at the moment. Should he bother to clip onto the tank beside him? If there was an explosion, it wouldn't help much. It might even rip his pea suit apart.
Can you see the pressure gauge from where you are, sir?
No.
It's dropping. We've got you on full monitoring now. It's still dangerous.
Do we need a bigger hole?
It wouldn't hurt.
Will do, sir.
Baron tried not to think of the effect on a puddle of cold gas of vibrations, shaking it, dispersing it faster than it might have gone on its own, mixing it. He kept his eyes on the far end, where suddenly a large section of bulkhead seemed to fold back like paper, and he was looking out into blackness speckled with lights that might be stars or the work lights of the outside repair crews.
Got it.
Get yourselves out. It'll start flowing your way.
What about you?
Oh, I think Gormley and I will stand here a while and let things clear out. Go on now.
The lights moved up the compartment toward the airlock entrance, more slowly than he wanted. Probably O'Neill was making them stay on the safety line. Airflow out that size hole wouldn't be strong, but the deck down there was slick. 2 reached the airlock, opened it, and went through. The others were almost there. Baron turned his head to watch them as they worked their way up the inboard bulkhead, the arc of his headlamp sweeping across the compartment.
No! Don't leave me behind!
Baron looked back to see Gormley plunge away from his position.
No! Don't!
He knew as he said it that once in motion, Gormley wouldn't stop, that he had miscalculated again, this time in his judgment of men. Baron had time for a thought of Esme. Esme stared at the same page she'd read many times before. She had nothing to do. With the ship overcrewed, no one needed her help. Hours and days ran together. She tried not to think about how long it was taking to get anywhere, how much time passed in which anything might be happening. The Fortune's last data feed, before going into jump, had included nothing substantive about the mutiny, only speculation as to its effect on prices. Baron was out there somewhere. He might be in combat. And here she was, stuck on a ship that might just as well have Target blaring from its beacon. She held a mental argument with his grandmother, in which, since she had both sides, she could win. In real life, admirals had the power. In the middle of her sleep shift, Esme rolled over, tangling her legs in the sheet yet again.
Damn it!
She closed her eyes firmly, until speckles and smears of light rolled across the darkness, and she could feel Baron's touch on her face, her neck, her body. She could smell him, taste him. He was calling her, longing and fear both in his voice. And then, in a great flash of light, he was gone.
Ow! Damn it!
Esme sat up abruptly and banged her head smartly on the cabinet overhead.
Will I ever see him again? Is he even alive?
She snapped on the light, blinked back hot tears, set her jaw, and grabbed a robe. She could go shower. Esme opened the door to find Betharnia standing just outside.
I heard a thud. I wondered if you were all right.
I'm fine. I'm going for a shower.
No one hit you?
No.
You have a lump on your head at the hairline.
No one hit me. You can look if you want to.
Esme flung the door aside, but Betharnia caught it in mid-swing and took a very thorough look inside.
Ah.
Satisfied that I'm not hiding a lover?
Yes. And that you are miserable.
Betharnia closed the compartment door quietly.
It's none of your business.
Esme headed for the showers, but the woman kept stride with her.
It may be my business if you endanger us. You were having nightmares?
You were just standing around outside my compartment spying on me?
No, I was not. I was walking past. I heard mutterings and then a loud noise like someone being hit, then a curse, then the click of a light switch, then the rustle of clothing, then you came out and—
You couldn't hear all that.
I have very good hearing. It is a curse.
It is a fake.
You're not so polite as you are at meals, Sarah.
It is the middle of my sleep shift. I've had no sleep. I had a bad dream. I whacked my head on the cabinet. And yes, you're right. I'm upset and miserable.
A shower is a very good idea, then.
They had come to the door of the shower area. Betharnia turned away.
Don't make it too hot.
You just going to walk off?
The woman waved a hand in a gesture that could have meant any of several things and kept walking. Esme walked into the shower room and saw herself in the mirrors above the sinks. The rapidly purpling lump was all too obvious.
Baron! 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 Baron!
And entirely too much. She beat her fists on the smooth, cold edge of one of the sinks. No one came in. As far as she knew, no one heard. Then she went into a shower cubicle and washed off the sweat and tears of her misery. Back in her compartment, she went to sleep and slept until the alarm rang. At breakfast, Basil stared at her forehead. She already knew what she looked like. She had seen it while getting dressed.
Who slugged you?
Nobody. I woke up too fast in the middle of the night and whacked myself on the cabinet.
Did you put ice on it?
No, I didn't even think of that.
That you should always put ice on it. When my daughter falls down and gets a bump, my wife puts ice on it.
Betharnia strolled in.
Ah, you have a wife?
You know I do.
But the back of his neck slowly turned a rich crimson. Esme watched, fascinated.
And you, Sira, your head is better?
Much better. If anyone needs any help, I'm quite able to stand a watch today.
She offered every day. Gunnar came in with a plateful of something that smelled delicious.
No, you're not standing any watches. You're our guest.
Well, I should make myself useful.
What you would be most useful for is probably not something you want to do. We could use some information on this mutiny business, for instance.
A chill ran down Esme's back.
I don't have any.
Ah, well, I didn't expect you would, or that you'd tell us if you did. Loyalty's a good thing to have, even to something you're estranged from. Families change their minds.
I don't think Fleet will.
You never know. And your sort of talent isn't limited to combat operations anyway. Tactical sense is useful in many places.
But
I loved it was the wrong thing to say, Esme knew.
However, if there are unclassified things you could tell us, what we might expect as traitors from Fleet in this mutiny situation, or what the mutineers might do...
I haven't been briefed. I was on my way to a new duty station. I know what's on the news, that's about all. But if I had to guess, I'd say this is a serious attempt to seize power, a military coup. There are people in Fleet who think the civilian government is weak and doesn't support the military enough.
Basil leaned forward and gave her a look clearly meant to convey unusual trust.
That sounds like our cousin Kaim. Kaim's in Fleet himself, a senior NCO, but he's always been a bit odd, and on his last visit home, he was extremely odd. We don't know if he's finally lost it. His father did. Or what to think.
Do you think he's part of the mutiny?
I don't know. I hope not.
He's always going on about plots and things. Mostly we don't pay attention to him. Not that we see him that often, unless we can see how it affects trade. Last time, he was talking about rejuvenation problems and how he thought Fleet was using NCOs as lab animals, he said. That's why they shut down inquiry into the rejuve failures.
Everybody's had some bad drug batches come out of the Patchcock plants, and from what I heard, it was Hobart Constantine who shut off research on it.
It occurred to Esme then that if the mutiny had anything to do with rejuvenation, that probably meant it wasn't supported by the Consulines.
Ah, that makes sense. This whole rejuvenation thing, it's going to make trouble one way or another. Take me. The way our company's set up, the old yield place to the young as the young mature. What's to happen if the old don't, if they stay young? It wouldn't matter if it were only a few rich people, but what if my uncle and father were still ship captains? Where would I be?
I don't know.
But do you think the mutineers will attack civilian ships, traders, other civilian targets?
They might. To put pressure on the government, they'd have to either defeat the loyal military or show that it can't protect you, or both. I'm afraid you can expect trouble, and soon.
Gunnar shook his head.
I should tell you, Sarah, that we're carrying a fugitive to Castle Rock. A priest from the Benignity.
A priest?
Yes. He says they think he's a heretic with some kind of secret. Fleet knows about him. They'll take charge of him at Castle Rock.
What would Fleet want with a priest?
I don't know. I just want him off our hands.
Gunnar glanced at the chronometer.
I'd better be off.
He hadn't expected to wake up. He'd said sorry and goodbye and all that. The lights scared him.
Turn those off!
He didn't recognize his own voice. Then a dark shape came between him and the light. For an instant, he saw it flying away, silhouetted against the light. Then it resolved into a person beside the bed.
Take it easy, Serrano.
He blinked, and his vision cleared. He was a Serrano, though he wasn't sure which one. Serrano meant duty, meant expectations, meant someone had died, and it was his fault.
How many?
Do you know your name?
Serrano.
Full name?
Baron blinked again. He was fairly sure he wasn't one of the female Serranos.
Sabato.
Still confused. Back to sleep, son.
He was fairly sure it wasn't his father. Darkness closed over him while he was still puzzling about it. The next time, he woke with brutal clarity, perfectly aware of who he was, Lieutenant Junior Grade Baron Serrano, and what had happened. Because he had screwed up, men were dead. He was no more use than he had been on Kosciusko when he'd been a captive. His head felt as if someone were hitting it with a hammer, and he knew that was right and just.
Do you know your name?
Baron glanced over at the person in the green scrubs, recognized him as belonging in sickbay.
Yes. Baron Serrano, Lieutenant Junior Grade.
Do you know where you are?
Sickbay, Rosa Major.
Right. Do you know what day it is?
No. Was I knocked out?
You could put it that way. You could also say you were damn near killed. Do you remember any of it?
No.
He didn't, really, though he had a few burning images. A dark shape flying through flame, a great black gap with stars beyond.
Somebody died.
Yeah, but a damn sight fewer than there'd have been without you.
How many?
Two. The idiot who panicked, and somebody blown out the hole in the bulkhead, only he hit the edge. Three of you with injuries, burns, broken bones. You're the worst. You were right in the middle of it, from what I gather. But you're alive. Now, answer me some more questions, son, so I can get on with my work.
Sure.
Who's chair of the Grand Council?
Hobart Consuline?
Grand Admiral?
Savanche.
Who's captain of this ship?
I can't remember.
That's all right. What's 2 plus 2?
4.
Good. Now, what hurts?
My head.
Baron tried to ask himself if anything else hurt, but his head dominated.
Well, we can't put you in a regen tank until the concussion resolves. The pressure's down. We've done some surgical fixation. That's why you're mostly immobilized.
Baron hadn't noticed, but now he realized he wasn't able to move. The next day, his seniors descended on him in a group. He braced himself for condemnation, but instead they told him he was a credit to the service. He couldn't understand why they were praising him when it was his fault to start with. If he'd paid more attention during his ensign rotation in environmental, he'd have known they used a specialized chem scan. He wouldn't have ignored Juan's complaint that his unit didn't have all those fancy names. If he'd paid more attention in chemistry, he'd have known that methane had a molecular weight of 16. He'd have known that even at low pressure and low temperature, oxygen and methane formed an explosive mix across a wide range of concentrations. If he'd known Gormley better, if he'd had more persuasive ability, more command presence, the kid wouldn't have panicked and bolted like that. If he'd known what he should have known, if he'd made sure they had the right equipment, the explosion would never have happened. Gormley would still be alive, Batenkin would still be alive, O'Neill and Avere and Talene wouldn't have been hurt. There wouldn't be a hole in that bulkhead, and the ship wouldn't be missing almost half its life support. The headache subsided, but the ache in his heart did not. When O'Neill came and thanked him a few days later, that made it worse.
I'm sorry. I should have...
You did the best you could, sir. Tell you the truth, when you said methane, I sort of froze. I couldn't think, just wanted to run like Gormley did. But you had a plan.
Not much of one.
That's not what the environmental officer said. He said it was a goddamn miracle anyone got out alive, and the ship didn't blow. And he wouldn't have liked to stand there the way you did.
I can't remember much of it, to be honest.
Well, just as well, probably. Avere and Talene were in the lock. Batenkin and I were next, and Batenkin had unclipped to go through when the flash came. The overpressure slammed the lock back through into the corridor. That's how Avere and Talene got hurt, smacked against the bulkhead there. Then it sucked back out, Batenkin with it. If I hadn't been holding on to the safety bar, I'd have gone too. I didn't see what happened to you, exactly, but they found you kind of caught in some of the piping. Your leg had jammed, and they think that's what kept you from being swept out with a blast. Gormley was dead, and you were alive, just barely.
Baron blinked back tears he hoped O'Neill didn't see.
I couldn't stop him. I was too far.
Now, sir, you know if you'd moved, it would have done the same thing. You gave us all the best chance you could, just standing there. Nobody's blaming you.
How's the ship?
Limping along. I doubt they'll be able to do much but scrap her. Lost a third of the FTL nodes. They're sending a DSR here to see if they can do anything.
They wouldn't send a deep space repair ship unless Rosa Major couldn't make it back on her own. Baron pushed away the memory of the Kosciusko going to the rescue, of himself as captive, that earlier humiliation.
Got two of the mutineer ships, but three made it out of the system. The good news? Fleet's got the Copper Mountain system back. Scuttlebutt is, they're sending wounded there for advanced care.
Baron's last memory of Copper Mountain was that ridiculous quarrel with Esme. Suddenly, he wanted Esme, wanted her fiercely. But what would she say? Esme, twice and three times a hero, who always did the right thing in a crisis. What would she think of him? Would she be ashamed? And she wasn't even in Fleet anymore.
Will I ever see her again?
Cecilia DeMarctos, en route to the Guerny Republic with Miranda Meager Thornbuckle, ignored the warnings about the mutiny with her usual blithe assumption that no one would interfere with her. She registered her flight plan with the nearest fleet headquarters so as not to be mistaken for a pirate or foreign spy, but refused their advice to take passage on a commercial liner.
The mutineers aren't going to bother with two old women on a tiny little ship like Pounce.
But they might, and you're helpless if they do.
I think the risk of traveling on a large commercial liner with hundreds of other potential hostages is much greater.
Cecilia had not told them her passenger's identity. Miranda would make a fine hostage, but she didn't intend to become one.
I can't stop you. I can only advise you very strongly...
Not to do it. Yes, I understand. Still, it's my old bones, and I never expected to live this long anyway. Miranda waited until they'd undocked and were well on the outbound leg before she commented.
And you think Brunn got a reckless attitude from me?
She's not my daughter. Cecilia had all the automatic devices available for such ships, but jump insertion was still tricky. Her course would, she hoped, take her safely past all the probable trouble zones in a series of linked jumps, popping them back into real space on the Guernsey border.
People tried to warn Brunn, and she ended up a prisoner.
That was different. Cecilia had the uneasy feeling that it wasn't that different, but she also knew there would be no way to conceal Miranda's identity if they took a commercial ship. Especially in the current political crisis, such ships demanded positive identification, and someone would be sure to tip off the news vids. As far as anyone outside the immediate family knew, Miranda was still on Cerealis. Cecilia had been regretting her bright idea for some days now. Miranda, though perfectly sane in her behavior, was not the travel companion she would have chosen for such tight quarters. Miranda belonged in a suite, with room for a maid, not in Pounce's narrow passage and meager compartments. They couldn't pass each other without bumping hips. Worse, she could not forget the sight of Miranda's lunge at Pater, that instant's motion she'd seen before the man collapsed. It had taken an act of will not to remove every sharp object from the little ship's tiny galley, but no act of will could keep her from having nightmares. She had willingly locked herself up alone with a murderer. But Miranda wouldn't kill her. She had done nothing to Miranda or her children. Of course, she was the only person to whom Miranda had confessed.
I don't suppose you'll ever tell me where Brunn's children are.
I thought you didn't want to know.
I'd like to know if you're sure they're safe.
Yes, absolutely certain. They're with families who love them. They have family names to grow into. The last time I saw them, they were healthy and happy.
That's good. I thought, after you'd gone, that perhaps we should have asked around Brunn's friends. Someone like Rafa, for instance, might have been able to place them.
Cecilia clamped her teeth together and hoped her face had betrayed nothing. Rafa has her own life now. I very much doubt...
You're right. I was forgetting. I'm so used to having her around to help Brunn, but she's married Ronnie and they're off pioneering someplace, aren't they?
Berenice is still quite annoyed with Ronnie about that. She didn't mind his marrying Raffaella, but she did not approve of their decision to emigrate.
If Cecilia could keep the conversation on Ronnie's mother's feelings, that might be safe ground.
I know he's your nephew, Cecilia, but he did always seem a bit more flighty than our boys.
According to his mother, he's not flighty now. The last word she had was a message cube with a video of him and Raffaella, both of them sunburnt and dirty, grinning like idiots, is how she put it.
Any grandchildren yet?
Cecilia chose to interpret that the way her sister would have.
No, and she's not pleased about that either. Apparently she and Raffaella's mother have had a set-to about it, because Raffaella's brother and Penelope Price Lyndhurst just had a baby. Berenice is claiming it's not fair. Luckily, I wasn't there, but apparently it rattled the teacups.
Berenice is so unlike you.
So I've heard all my life. I keep trying, but we are never going to get along.
Cecilia leaned back in her seat. Maybe it wasn't going to be so bad. If they could talk about other people's children the whole trip, it would be boring, but safe. She hoped Miranda would have the sense to keep off politics. Day by day, through the sequence of jump points, they worked their way across familiar space. Miranda proved capable of producing edible meals from the small galley and spent quite a bit of time in her compartment. Cecilia's nightmares ceased. She no longer tensed up when Miranda came up behind her when she was in the pilot's seat. She did occasionally wonder what was going on in the world outside, how far the mutiny had progressed, where Harris Serrano was, but that was someone else's problem. She had enough to do, keeping Pounce on course. Cecilia and Miranda were just sitting down to mugs of soup when the down-jump transition occurred, 6 hours ahead of schedule. The ship quivered like a horse shaking off flies and then lurched abruptly. Hot soup landed in Cecilia's lap.
Malfunction. Proximity alarm. Excessive flux.
She jumped up and staggered into the cabinet as the ship lurched again. Cecilia groped for an ice pack for her scalded leg. Clutching the ice bag to her leg, Cecilia edged carefully along, one hand on a grab bar or other handhold, until she was back in the pilot's seat.
What did I do wrong?
She'd checked and rechecked the charts. She should have been safely distant from any large mass. All the jump points she'd entered were green-coded, safe and stable. Half her control panel telltales glowed red. Jump drive down, in-system drive down, shields down. Cecilia cut the power to emergency level. The lights dimmed. Then she made herself go through the checklist, ignoring the red lights unless they were on it. First was hull integrity, still green. Then atmosphere, still green. She knew that already. She was alive and conscious, so there had to be air. Then environmental systems, yellow. She hesitated, but the protocol said keep going. She keyed it to the shortlist and went on. When she'd worked her way through to the reds, drives, shields, long scan, the minimal weapons she carried, she came back to the yellows.
What's the school?
We've got an intact hull, something to breathe, and some damage to environmental. Yes, correctable. I need to reset the trays and a filter's come loose. Otherwise, we're not going anywhere real soon.
Except they were, at their exit velocity, which was faster than she'd have chosen. But she'd deal with that later.
What happened?
I don't know yet.
Cecilia took the yellow list and headed back to deal with what could be fixed quickly and easily. Item after item returned to green status. They weren't leaking air. Internal power was adequate for all uses at present. All environmental systems were functioning correctly. The reds were beyond her capability. Beyond anyone's in such a small ship. Even if she'd known how to fix the drives, she couldn't have accessed them. She came back to the pilot's compartment and shook her head at Miranda.
Now, I have to figure out where we are and how fast we're moving. We're purely ballistic at this point.
And what happened?
Yeah, and what happened, if I can. You never got any spacecraft ratings, did you?
No. I have atmospheric licenses for flitters and helos, but not spacecraft.
Well, while I'm working on position and course, suppose you take a look at this.
Cecilia took a hard copy manual out of the bin under her seat.
I don't want to use more power than necessary.
I see. Then you'd like me to go shut down the galley, I suppose?
Yes, if the shift to emergency didn't cut it off automatically.
She couldn't remember at the moment whether it would or not. Cecilia opened the cover of the emergency position locator system and read the instructions graved on the inside of the cover. Supposedly, this system, with its own internal power pack, could place them accurately anywhere in Familius space. She hoped they were still in Familius space. The EPLS, designed for emergency use, had only a short list of instructions. Cecilia entered their previous course data, the last jump point they should have passed, and waited for something to come up on the screen. Waiting for calculations, in glowing red letters. She stared at it for a long moment, then became aware of the pain in her leg.
The burn.
She'd dropped the ice pack somewhere while attending to the loose filter fitting.
Miranda!
Yes?
See if you can find the ice pack. I put it down while I was working back near the berths. Make sure I didn't leave it to melt somewhere troublesome.
Right.
The steady red glow didn't change. Cecilia had no idea how long the calculations would take, if the device worked at all. She pulled the damp fabric of her slacks away from the painful spot on her leg. She didn't want to leave the bridge. Looking around, she remembered that she hadn't tried retrieving the automatic log. With one eye on waiting for calculations, Cecilia tried to read the automatic log. At first, it made no sense. Then she remembered that she needed to convert it to a text function. The jumble of symbols sorted themselves out into a sketchy journal. There was jump point RVD 45.7, and then elapsed time 28.52 standard hours, jump point TVD 31.8. 2 standard hours later, 2.13 actually, they had passed within the E-radius of a mass sufficient to cause jump downshift. All Cecilia really knew about E-radii and masses was that the bigger the mass, the bigger the E-radius that must be avoided. Usually, this was a problem only in insertion and exit, when someone wasn't using mapped points. In a ship the size of hers, it shouldn't be a problem, unless she actually ran headlong into something. But she had used mapped points, and a standard green-scored route. No one else had run into trouble on this route, and once in jump, the very indeterminacy of position was supposed to make it safe. The mass that they had passed too near wasn't even moonlet-sized, let alone planet-sized. Cecilia tapped for interpretation, one of the options on the screen. The screen blanked. Looking up data, it said. She glanced back at the other, which still read, waiting for calculations. The autolog screen changed first, offering a range of possibilities. All were ships.
Ships?
One, very large container freighter fully loaded with high-mass cargo. Two, very large container freighters fully loaded with average cargo. Three, the list went on. Cecilia didn't think two or three or four container ships would be traveling in close convoy, but farther down the list, item 8 gave her pause.
Flotilla or wave of military vessels with aggregate mass as above traveling in close convoy.
In other words, she had split or nearly split a group of military ships whose combined mass was sufficient to pop her out of jump and disable her FTL drive.
Oh, great.
What?
If the autolog is right, then the most probable cause of our sudden exit from FTL was that we ran into a cluster of military ships.
I wonder what we did to them.
Possibly nothing. Possibly we blew them away. But if we didn't...
They might be after us. I wonder if they're mutineers or loyalists.
Me too. Did you find that ice pack?
Yes. You dropped it in the sink. How's your leg?
It hurts, but not too badly. Ah, here we are.
The figures the EPLS displayed made no immediate sense, but at least it had figures. Cecilia jotted them down, then called up a graphics display. They were still in familiar space, but that was about all the good news. They'd come out in a region of relatively sparse, habitable worlds. The nearest mapped systems were 2 and 3 jump points away, respectively. Copper Mountain. She knew that from the hoorah about Brun's abduction. It was a fleet base. It was also, the memory jolted her like ice cubes down the spine, it was also where the mutiny had started.
Son of a motherless...
Bad news?
Bad news. Copper Mountain's the closest inhabited system. Want to bet the ships we almost hit were mutineers?
Passive scan made it clear that they were a long way from anything useful. Some 18 AU away, the nearest star glowed orange. Cecilia left the scan on, and after 2 minutes, it had coded 6 dots as possible ships based on their relative motion. Another minute, and the color shifted, confirming them as artificial and under power. They were accelerating away. The mass sensor reported an aggregate mass very close to what the autolog had postulated as the cause of dropout. Miranda leaned over Cecilia's shoulder.
That's what we nearly hit, I gather.
Yeah. Whatever and whoever it is.
The sinking feeling in her gut said they were mutineers. Had to be.
Are you going to try hailing them?
Without knowing? No. Let them think we're a dead issue.
They might well be a dead issue anyway, if she couldn't get one of the drives up and running.
Fine with me. But we can listen, can't we?
I don't know if our communication's working at all.
The telltale had gone from red to yellow by itself, and Cecilia didn't trust it.
I guess we can try, though.
She turned the receivers on and ran through the settings.
Do you think it could have been a ship?
Not likely. Got anything on scan?
Cecilia tried to interpret the passive scan data and wished she'd paid more attention when Kutsudis and Oblo were talking to Brun about scan technique. How far away were those ships? And whose were they?
There it is. It's little. That's why it didn't blow itself and us to bits. Drives are dead. It's ballistic. But there is a chance the crew are alive.
Not our problem. They're unlikely to report us, and without a working drive.
So it was the mutineers. Cecilia looked at Miranda, who had gone white. She understood.
We don't know the drive's dead. They might have turned it off. We can't take the chance. Too much has been going wrong.
Doesn't this system have a navigation beacon? A fleet ansible? Something?
Cecilia looked up.
It's uninhabited.
There's a mapped jump point, but it's considered inferior. There's some big lump of metal barreling in an eccentric orbit, which causes some kind of problem. Wait, there's an Ansible. There's been a research station here. Trouble is, I don't know if it's accessible to civilian signals. Let's see.
Will they notice if we hail it?
Cecilia selected the listed frequency.
Probably. And we don't have a functioning tight beam or any of the other goodies I wish we had. But they already know we're here, and they're going to come after us. If we can get a signal to that Ansible, we can at least let Fleet know where some mutineers are.
Where they were, that is. They wouldn't stay in this system.
And maybe, if they realize we've signaled, they'll decide to run for it and leave us behind. We'll already have done all the damage we can.
Miranda eyed the scan on which the marked icons had changed color, with lengthening cones to indicate course change and acceleration.
Somehow, I don't think they'll do that.
Probably not.
Cecilia entered the pulse combination for the Ansible and crossed her fingers. 6 full minutes for that signal to reach the Ansible, 6 to return, and she had to wait for confirmation before sending any message. She knew all too well how much could happen in 12 minutes. 2 of the distant ships disappeared from scan, and 2 possible ship icons appeared much closer. Microjump, of course. She retuned the frequency to the one they'd eavesdropped on before.
Got the transponder.
Damn.
She'd forgotten that going to emergency power did not cut off the ship's automatic ID signal. In fact, it boosted the power to it, on the grounds that any ship in an emergency would want to be found. They must be lit up like a candelabra on the military ship's scans.
Pounce, owner Cecilia DeMarctos. Isn't that the bitch who's crazy about horses? The one who hired Harris Serrano as a captain?
Yes!
Admiral Minor Arash Levadi stared blindly at the wall of his office. With the Star had come considerably more work than he'd anticipated, despite Admiral Serrano's honest attempt to make the changeover easy on him. Not only were all the experienced flag officers gone, but so were a startling number of the senior NCOs. Anyone who had had a rejuvenation. He hadn't ever noticed how many personnel had had a rejuve. He hadn't even decided what he'd do when his own number came up in a few years. And now the mutiny, and all those personnel were coming back, the fit ones at least. The gossip mill, operating at translight speed through illicit private communications on fleet ansibles, warned that former admirals were moving right back into their places, and the recently promoted were scrambling to find a place. He wondered what he was supposed to do. It would be easier to go back to commanding a ship, and he knew himself to be a good captain. But his ship, he still thought of his last command as his ship, and his crew were far away, over on the Benignity border, under a new captain. He considered the forces available. Harris Serrano's ship was here, and she'd been assigned another, halfway across Familius space. He knew many of her crew, and they knew him. He considered volunteering to take it. Otherwise, the incoming admiral he expected any day would certainly question why he hadn't assigned someone already, why it wasn't out on patrol like the others. It made sense in more ways than one. Arash did not like considering all the ways. There were things in his life he preferred to forget and ignore. If no one knew, no one would be hurt by the knowledge. That Harris Serrano's ship and Harris Serrano's crew might be insurance against that discovery, he didn't quite allow himself to recognize. He might as well prepare the ship. He might as well make a plan that would convince the incoming admiral of his good intentions. He called in his clerk.
Please inform the officer in charge, Board Vigilance.
That'll be Lieutenant Commander McKay.
That I need to see him at his earliest convenience.
Within a half-standard hour, McKay stood before him.
I'm sure you've wondered why Vigilance wasn't sent out on patrol.
Well, yes. We thought at first we were waiting for Commander Serrano to return.
Of course, but she was assigned to Indefatigable. I frankly thought they'd be revising the assignments as soon as people had time to recover from the first shock, so I didn't hurry to put someone into Vigilance. Out here on the border is the ideal place for a combat experienced commander, and I thought she'd be back. But Apparently not. Now, we know another flag officer's coming to take over this headquarters, and I'm going to ask for vigilance myself. I know that any ship Hera Serrano has commanded will be combat ready, and she and I have been friends for years.
I see, sir. The crew will be glad to get out of dock and into space again. Does the Admiral think the new Admiral will agree?
I expect so. Why not? A few months behind a desk doesn't make me overqualified for ship command.
Well, of course, sir.
In any case, whoever gets her will probably use her for his flagship. We should be putting the extra communications gear aboard and making sure there's space for the Admiral's staff.
Sir, we anticipated that she might become a flagship, and most of that's in place. If the Admiral has time, he might want to come aboard and look over the changes.
I'll make the time.
Arash noted that Vigilance's crew had put the flag function some distance aft of the bridge, but in line with it, displacing the senior officer's wardroom. This was one of the two most common configurations for large cruisers. The other put the flag space directly across the port corridor from the bridge access, but that was a busier area, and most admirals preferred the aft location. With duplication of bridge readouts and communications, it was just as convenient. Arash approved. Not entirely to his surprise, Vida Serrano arrived to take her own office back. Arash did his best to conceal his chagrin when he noticed her staff's burst of enthusiasm. They had worked well for him, but he had never had the kind of warm reception they showed her.
The Serrano mystique.
He wondered for a moment if his request to take over Harris Serrano's ship was such a good idea as it had seemed before. But Admiral Serrano brought up the topic before he could sheer away. It was clear she thought Admirals minor with combat experience should be out there in fighting ships.
I'd be commanding from a ship myself if my orders didn't specifically prohibit it. You'd better take Vigilance. Harris's exec will make you a good flag captain, I don't doubt.
That'll be fine, Admiral. But actually, I was thinking of Commander Burleson. He's been with me quite a while. We're used to working together. He has combat experience. He was my XO on Firedrake, and then again on Emperor Roy.
Well, someone you're used to could be a real help. I was hoping to keep Burleson on staff here, but you'll be the one under fire.
Thank you, sir.
Arash managed not to heave an audible sigh of relief. He was sure Harris's exec was capable or more, but the man's coolness towards him would make it just that bit more difficult to work together. Maybe the man would resent being displaced.
In that case, I think I'll give McKay a ship. You can find someone for your exec, can't you?
Of course, Admiral.
With Burleson and Keller, he would have two people who were comfortable with him. And McKay wouldn't see himself as shunted aside if he were given a ship.
Thank you, sir.
You're quite welcome. I'm just sorry more of Harris's crew isn't available.
It'll work out.
Arash told himself that again when he packed up his things and had them taken over to Vigilance, and when he went aboard. Harris's crew, his now, certainly gave every evidence of superb training. They rendered the honors due an Admiral Minor coming aboard a flagship with precision and enthusiasm.
Welcome aboard, Admiral. We're looking forward to some action.
Congratulations on your new command. I hear your ship's in transit, due in a few days.
Yes, sir. I hate to leave old Vigilance, but my own ship.
You've earned it. Look here, we're all dealing with scratch crews. If you'd like to take a few people you know along with you, I'm sure we can work something out.
Are you sure, sir? Admiral Serrano said they still hadn't found me an exec, and there's a fine young fourth officer aboard. He's a bit junior, but...
Go ahead. You ought to have someone you're comfortable with on your first ship. I'll take a replacement. With the rest of this crew as experienced as they are, it's not a problem.
Thanks, sir. When will Captain Burleson be coming aboard?
Tomorrow morning, I think. He had a dental checkup. Tried to get out of it, but the surgeons grabbed him.
McKay seemed enthusiastic, and Arash, who had met the ship's officers frequently in the past few days, now felt the same warmth from all of them. He relaxed a little. Serrano mystique was one thing, but the Levadis knew something about command as well. Admiral Serrano had already complimented him on doing a good job under difficult conditions. The ones who worried him most, the ones who had been imprisoned on false charges when Harris left Fleet, seemed as cordial as the rest. He made a point of searching them out and greeting them, but he saw nothing in their eyes but respect. Several were now officers, and if Mustangs, they were capable Mustangs. Harris would have insisted on that, he knew. The ship felt good, the way a happy ship should. Burleson reported the same once he took over. He was waiting for the arrival of a light cruiser and some patrol craft that would form his combat group when word came that mutineer ships had begun hitting commercial vessels as they made the long in-system crawl from jump point to orbital station.
Something's cut them off from their supply base. They've hit ships carrying fleet resupply, including weaponry.
Admiral Vida Serrano looked at the group in her office.
We're going to start using convoys. I'm not waiting for HQ on this one. We need the cargoes, and we don't want the mutineers to have them. Admiral Levati, there's a supply run heading next week. You direct the convoy. We're not announcing it. They'll find out soon enough.
Organizing the convoy took several days. The civilian captains of the ships involved did not like the restrictions which a convoy would place on them. They argued that fleets should simply have enough patrols in any system to protect them. Arash wore his voice out explaining why this wouldn't work and finally had to ask Admiral Serrano to intervene. They had fleet contracts for some of their cargo, and therefore, she said, they were under fleet control until those cargoes were delivered.
Might as well be mutineers.
Think again. They take ears.
What?
Ears cut from the bodies they leave behind. Take a look.
She handed out flat pics of the carnage the mutineers had left behind on the Saffron Dynasty and the Cetus III. The captains blanched and gave in. The convoy moved out toward the jump point in a ragged formation flanked by four patrol ships and two escorts, with vigilance in the lead. Arash had read that in wet navies, ships could zigzag to avoid raiders. But zigzags were impractical in space, especially for ships which lacked the ability to micro-jump. He did insist on their practicing some maneuvers in formation, but Eliza Garnerin came within 1,300 meters of Haboob and so terrified both captains that it took all Arash's persuasive skill to keep them from dropping out altogether. On that first run to the more distant pickets, they met no mutineers. Arash's force stood by while supplies were moved from the cargo ships to those keeping station. They repeated the actions in one system after another, and Arash felt a growing confidence in both Vigilance and the others under his command. He overheard, and knew he was meant to overhear, favorable comments on his leadership. More importantly, his staff heard even more. Still, he worried. The mutineers' leader, supposedly, was one Solomon Drij, and Arash had reason to wish it had been someone else. They had both served under Admiral Lupescu as young men, and they had both fallen under the spell of his dubious charms. Arash had survived one witch hunt for old Lupescu connections because Lupescu had made it clear that he despised the young Levati. The scornful phrases still rang in his ears. Others had heard that scorn. It had been a permanent blot on his service record, the only one ever since. Yet in the long run, a good turn, for being known as an object of Lupescu's contempt was, after Lupescu's death, far better than being known as his protégé. Now, however, Drij and the other mutineers had brought Lupescu's loyal order of game hunters to Fleet's attention.
If Fleet mounts a search for potential mutineers among Lupescu's old associates, what else might they turn up?
Arash could tell from the reactions of his staff and crew that none of this turmoil showed on his face.
It shouldn't. I've had years to perfect my calm.
It was so unfair. He had never intended to do anything but the duty he was sworn to. He had not meant to jump from one very hot frying pan into an even hotter fire, and the displeasure of Lupescu and his supporters should have been fire enough. But it wasn't. A scalding worm of that fire crawled through his belly as he tried not to think about it. Warned by Lupescu that members of his own family were members of the Loyal Order of Game Hunters, Arash Levati dared not go to them. He had turned, in the hell Lupescu made of his life, to the only friend he could count on. An outsider from a colony world, but undaunted by the difficulties that placed in the way of a fleet career. Jules made friends with everyone, mended quarrels, and, to Arash's relief, had never been acceptable to Lupescu because of his total disinterest in blood sports. Tubby, cheerful Jules, who always had time to listen, whose advice was so often just what one wanted to hear.
When did Jules first ask me to do something I should not? And how could I have known?
Young officers helped each other out. Friends helped each other out. Everyone expected that, and always had. A little here, a little there. And only because Jules was his good friend, who had stood by him when, it seemed, the whole ship turned against him with Lepescu's disfavor. Jules had done him more than one good turn, too. If he had known. But hard as he poked and prodded his reluctant memory, he could not find any unequivocal clue to Jules's real nature. Not until many years later, when it was far too late. Not until it would have meant his career, if not his life, to let the truth be known.
The Serrano Legacy, Against the Odds, is continued on the next CD.